move your body. Dance. Repeated patterns that are rhythmic. Dance, dance, dance. Move your body.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Promote the Hell Out of It. My name is Misael Trujillo, and this is the podcast where I talk to experts about subjects worth promoting. And this is exactly that kind of episode. I am so excited to share it with everyone because I think it can help an incredible amount of people, myself included. It's a wonderful subject. I talked to Nikki McLean, complementary therapist and founder of Organized Minds, which focus on neurodevelopment and skills for learning. And we cover a lot of ground on the episode. We talk about what neurodevelopment are, what primitive reflexes are, how these things can affect us in later life, and why movement is so vital and important. We talk about reflexology, yoga, dancing, all of it. I really do hope you enjoy the episode, and I hope that everyone can share it about, because I think it can help a lot of people. And that is the aim of this podcast, to learn about subjects that are really worth knowing and that can help others when we talk about them in conversation. If you've been listening to the last few podcast episodes, you'll know that we've been sponsored by our friends at Nextstand. They are absolutely wonderful. They create highly adjustable and portable laptop stands that help with your posture and thus increase productivity and energy and all that kind of stuff. They're great. I've been using them loads. You can check them out on our Instagram stories and that kind of stuff. But we're also going to be running a competition because we've got some freebies for them for all of you as a thank you for listening. So go check that out on Instagram, Twitter. It's going to be coming up this week. Give us a like, give this episode a share, and I hope you enjoy it. Nikki, it is wonderful to have you on the podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
It is a really exciting subject for me to talk about because I've been interested in it for a long time and haven't really had the chance to ask anyone that knows the subject well, so I'm excited.
Okay. Well, I hope I didn't disappoint.
Oh, I'm sure you won't. I think I'd like everyone to be able to follow from the get-go, so maybe starting with what neurodevelopment is would be a good place to start.
Okay, well, neurodevelopment as I use it, is a way of using whole-body floor-based movements to allow the brain to develop and to integrate primitive reflexes where that development was not able to occur naturally at the time it should have done, which is kind of from conception to about 2 years old.
Okay, perfect. And one of the terms that came up when I was reading your blog post, which for anyone listening are wonderful if you want some more details on this subject, was the primitive reflexes. Could we maybe talk a little bit more about what those are?
Yes, so primitive reflexes are essential to development and nobody knows about them. They're a very well hidden secret for some reason, which I don't really understand why. The only reflex that people tend to be aware of is the Moro reflex or the baby startle reflex. And essentially what primitive reflexes are movement patterns from our central nervous system that promote development. So they are movement patterns that help to keep us safe, help to get us born, help to find food, help to roll over, move, crawl, eventually stand up and walk. And they all have a particular point where they should develop, and they develop and they fulfill their action. And then they should integrate into your central nervous system. And when they don't integrate fully, that's when problems occur. So you can have reflexes profoundly retained, which causes serious problems, or slightly retained, which causes less problems, but make life a bit more difficult than it needs to be.
Okay. And to get an idea of the kind of problems that can occur, if we start with what kind of physical things can happen because of these primitive reflexes?
So physically, with retained fear reflexes, which are the first reflexes to develop and cause lots of problems, but physically you get issues like digestive problems particularly. With the spinal reflexes, you often get lower back problems and again digestive issues. With retained neck reflexes, you get a lot of upper back problems, neck, shoulder problems, migraines. But things like flat feet, problems with grip and grasp, postural problems, other things that you tend to see, scoliosis, things like that, tend to be the physical problems that are associated with retained reflexes.
And from reading your blog, there were some really like funny little quirks that I even thought about in myself. Like someone had mentioned when they were driving and they looked behind them that their whole body kind of swerves in that direction. Yeah. And I thought that was wonderful. And how about the other side? How about how these reflexes can affect our behaviour, how we react in situations, things like that? That's what I was really interested in.
Yeah, it is really interesting. You know, and all reflexes have mental and emotional symptoms, for want of a better word, alongside the physical symptoms. So again, back to the fear reflexes. Retained fear reflexes don't make you fearful per se, but they stop you from feeling safe in your world. And because they are a reflex, so you have no control over them, you end up with these behaviour patterns that really don't make any sense. So people go for counselling or other therapies, but fundamentally it's that reflex that needs to integrate. So things like post-traumatic stress disorder, OCD, generalised anxiety, aggression, manipulation, people are very manipulative, people who find it very difficult to speak out in public, people who generally feel that the world is not a safe place. So if you imagine how that would feel, that actually when you leave your home you're not safe, then you change your behaviour in order to try and make yourself feel safe. And of course OCD is a really good example of that, because if you don't feel safe in the world and your logical brain externalises that problem and goes, okay, I don't feel safe because I haven't checked the front door, so I'll check the front door and then I'll check it again, then I'll check it again, then I'll check it again. But that still doesn't make you feel safe. So you go, okay, so I don't feel safe, so I will make sure I've turned the tap off, and you do that 10 times and you still don't feel safe. And that's kind of how it can then escalate. It's this feeling of insecurity that no matter what you do, you can't change it. And the reason is because it's a reflex. And of course, those reflexes are associated with the vagus nerve and the development of the vagus nerve in utero. So that's why there's the digestive associations. So if you are living your life in a permanent state of fight and flight, you get all the symptoms that are associated with that.
Yeah, and this is part of why I find this so incredibly interesting. I've got a lot of problems with my digestion, and the time they started was when I was homeless for 5 years in London. So reading a lot of your blog posts has helped me understand a lot of maybe where the issues are coming from.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly interesting to understand how it can interfere in ways you might not expect.
Yeah.
One of the things I thought was interesting that you wrote about was how it can interfere with an ambition, for example, if you want to be a leader in your workplace.
Yes, if this comes from Brené Brown's work. I'm a big fan of Brené Brown, and I was reading her new book, Dare to Lead, and she talks about being an effective leader, you have to be vulnerable, and how being vulnerable is incredibly difficult and being vulnerable is incredibly brave, you know, which we all understand, and that to be a leader you have to drop your armour and get into the arena and be vulnerable with your employees or your team. And I was thinking, because I tend to see things through that filter of reflexes. And I know, and I'm sure most people have come across people like that, people who really want to be progressive, effective leaders and managers. But when things get really tough, their personality changes. And if that's the case, then often that's where reflexes kick in. So where I said at the beginning, reflexes can be profoundly retained and you end up with lots of pathology, or they can be slightly retained and just interfere with your life. So that would be the category I would put those kind of people in, that they really want to be effective leaders and make themselves vulnerable. But as soon as they're challenged, those reflexes kick in. And you have to understand that it's a reflex, so therefore you can't control it. So it's not a decision that you've made. It is a reflex about defending yourself and keeping yourself safe. So depending on where that vulnerability is, or where your own personal how your own personal fear reflex manifests, you then have people who suddenly become micromanagers or manipulative or overbearing and domineering and can't cope with change and can't cope with new ideas, and they don't want to hear this and they don't want to do that, because that fear reflex has taken over that logical brain.
And I think for anyone listening, myself included obviously, who maybe can identify themselves in those traits sometimes, it can seem incredibly daunting, and that's where I want to lead onto the work you do. Because is it something that is built in and can't be fixed, or is there a way to work on these things?
No, absolutely. It can be, well, fixed is a difficult one. It can be improved on. Can it be fixed altogether? Sometimes it can, sometimes it can't. It depends on so many other factors. But what we can do at any age is improve the function to make life easier. So as I said, I use movement to help that process. So you can use movement to encourage those reflexes to integrate. And obviously the younger you are, so with children, we see things change relatively quickly usually and more permanently. With adults, we see change occur reasonably quickly, but it's probably less permanent, you know, and I started doing this work about 5 or 6 years ago. So I'm aware of the changes in myself, but I'm also aware that I need to keep doing my movement program to keep things in control. And if I don't keep on it, I'm aware when things start to slip back a bit. So, you know, that's 50 odd years of unintegrated reflexes. It's not going to change necessarily overnight.
Of course. And for someone listening who's in a similar situation, maybe with a lot of years of these reflexes built in, what is the best place for them to start?
I would always recommend finding a good therapist. There are online programs, but the problem with an online program is that there's nobody there to correct you or guide you. So if you're doing the movements incorrectly, they're not going to do what they're supposed to do. And similarly, if you're somebody who has retained fear reflexes and you're working at that level, really you need the support of a therapist to guide you through if things get to be uncomfortable. The problem with working with fear reflexes is that they make you feel unsafe. When you feel unsafe, the prospect of change is difficult. When you start to integrate those reflexes, you become aware of that change. So therefore, you don't want to do it anymore because it's become too uncomfortable. So if you've got the support of a good therapist to talk you through it and support you through it and guide you through it, then you can do it. And when I talk about these movements, they're really simple. They're floor-based or bed-based, but, you know, lying down, rhythmic, rocking movements that you do for only a few minutes every day. It's not a time-consuming program. It isn't a long process that you have to do every day. It's fairly short, but it's very effective. I use a system called rhythmic movement training, which is absolute genius because it takes advantage of our innate sense of rhythm. You know, as we're very rhythmic beings, and rhythm really, really helps to encourage those connections to build. And also, particularly working with fear reflexes, rhythm really helps to settle those fear reflexes. There's other people who work in a similar kind of area, Peter Levine particularly, who is a somatic therapist. So he uses movement within his psychotherapeutic process to work with people who have had to deal with trauma.
And taking rhythmic movement training specifically, what kind of improvements could people expect to see, or what areas would they expect to see improvement in first?
Because it's an holistic process, so we work with the whole person rather than working on a specific reflex, then we generally see a generalised improvement of symptoms. So in my own case, I discovered when I was 40 that I was dyslexic and dyscalculic, which was actually a huge relief. You know, the whole argument around diagnoses, you know, sometimes a diagnosis is really useful. For me, I'd spent my whole life thinking I was stupid. When I discovered I was dyslexic, it was quite a relief. So dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia tends to be associated with retained neck reflexes. So I have quite strongly retained neck reflexes, and I used to have a real problem going downstairs. I mean, it sounds like a really silly thing. I used to have a real problem going downstairs and wasn't aware that it was an issue. I just thought it was, you know, that was just me. It's one of those things. When I started to do this work, not only did I find that my organisation was better, my concentration was better, I could focus better, but I also discovered I could come downstairs without holding on. which is such a random thing, but it's a good indication of where things shift. But generally I find sensory stuff improves first. So where people have sensory issues, noise, textures, touch, light, those kind of things, they tend to settle first. More physical things tend to improve. Often it's the behavioural things that tend to settle last, and I see that particularly with children. So, but when we work with neurodevelopment, we're focusing really on working in order that the brain develops. So your brainstem develops first, then your limbic system, then your cortex. So your cortex is your decision-making, or the prefrontal cortex is the decision-making part of your brain. So that's the part we tend to focus on last, and it's the part that tends to connect up last. And so that's really the logical part of your brain that then comes into it, sorted last of all. But it's, you know, that's a huge generalization. You know, when we work with integrating reflexes and creating those new neural pathways and getting the brain to connect up properly and different parts of it to talk to each other better, it's a process that happens all together. You know, we don't do this bit, then this bit, then this bit. You know, we're not cars, we're animals. So everything tends to improve together to a greater or lesser extent.
No, I think it makes sense when you hear someone explain it. I think it's quite logical, even the way you said little things are the things you notice first. I think that's generally how we learn other things, if that makes any sense. Like I play guitar, and you learn little things and still think that the bigger things are the issue, and suddenly the brain takes over and you don't think about that anymore.
Exactly. You know, and it's like putting puzzle pieces together. So, you know, you do the corners and the edges first, and then you can fill in the rest of it. It's when you get to the sky, it all gets a bit tricky.
Of course, yeah. And obviously, the people that can gain help from this, the issues they can have originally can escalate from quite mild to quite severe, I imagine. And I think on your blog post, I read that it can help with children who have had brain damage, for example.
Yeah, you know, the brain is plastic. So given the right input, the brain can rebuild itself and correct itself and work around things. And we still know so little about how the brain works. You know, we're learning more all the time. When I first started studying this, we know that you can grow new connections between brain cells at any point in your life. We then knew that you could grow new brain cells in the hippocampus, but only in the hippocampus. But more recently, we've discovered that you can grow new brain cells anywhere in the brain. So we know that we can encourage the brain to recover. Now, whether that would be recovering in its entirety is a difficult one. But we know that that we can improve connections, and we can improve function, and we can make life better. It's all about making life easier, you know, just make it easier. If your reflexes are working well, everything becomes easier.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's all these little things add up to a huge amount of stress.
Yeah.
And it can really be dominating your life without even realising it is, if you're waking up every morning in the same state.
Exactly. And of course, we adapt. Like my inability to walk downstairs, you know, I mean, that was just the way it is. And we're very adaptable. Darwin said that in Origin of the Species. It was never survival of the fittest. It was always survival of the most adaptable. And human beings are adaptable. And we adapt around our behaviour. And we adapt to having a bad back, or we adapt to the fact that our feet have got no arches in, and we adapt to the fact that, you know, we don't like to leave the house on our own after dark. You know, we and that we normalize things. That's one of the things I find a lot in a consultation with children where parents come in, where they normalize behavior to make it so that it's okay. But actually, if we can integrate reflexes and allow the brain to develop properly, all of a sudden you don't have to do that anymore. Everything becomes easier. You know, and things like when I do a screening, particularly for children, to check for retained reflexes, I don't do it after school. I'll only do it in the morning. Because if you are a child at school with retained reflexes, just sitting upright all day at a desk is exhausting. Because the reflexes that should be integrated in your system that allow you to sit up comfortably and naturally and sit still aren't there. So it becomes a process that your brain has to work on. Your brain has to instruct your body what to do, to keep upright, to sit still, to look ahead. And that whole process is exhausting. And then there's no space for learning. There's no room in your brain for learning because your brain is too busy trying to be compliant. Whereas if we can get those reflexes to integrate, then you can sit naturally and comfortably and focus on what you're supposed to be learning. Everything becomes easier.
Of course. And I want to touch a bit more on the coping strategies, because I think it can be easy to underestimate the effect that continually doing this can have.
Yeah.
And especially when mixed in with other situations. So I'll ask you, is there any correlation, for example, between lower income household and worse reflexes?
Cool. That's a difficult one to answer. I'm not aware of any research on that. What I would say is that where fear reflexes are retained, it then becomes very difficult for other reflexes to integrate. So if you come from a household where parents are very stressed or the family is quite dysfunctional, then that will then predispose your fear reflexes to not integrate, which then would then have a knock-on effect. But from a sociological perspective, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, though, because obviously there has been a lot of research into how lower-income students, for example, struggle to retain information as much just because of the situation at home. If on top of that you're adding this effort you're having to put into these coping strategies, your success rate must drop compared to other people who are in those situations massively.
Yeah.
Is there any way of thinking of solutions that can be applied to schools, to actual teaching situations for these issues?
Well, funny you should say that. We run a training course that is aimed at teachers and people who work with groups of children called School Readiness, which looks at reflexes in a very broad manner, not with a huge amount of depth. So we don't go massively into the neuroscience of it, but it's more about these are all the reflexes that you're likely to see. This is how it exhibits. This is how you can look for them in groups of children. These are the things that you can do to encourage them to integrate. So, you know, the simple answer would be, yes, let's get rhythmic movement training into all schools. But the problem is that neurodevelopment as a concept and as a practice has been around for about 70 years. And different neurodevelopment approaches have tried to get programs into school, and there isn't the will or the uptake. I think it's maybe a lack of understanding. I was a therapist for about 20 years before I found neurodevelopment, which I found because my daughter was diagnosed with dyslexia, and I was looking for something to help her. So the whole concept of primitive reflexes and what you can do about it seems to be very little known. So I think that as a therapist, as a practitioner, as an instructor, part of my job is to try and raise awareness, talk to people like you, so that people start to understand that there's a very, very practical reason why some of these problems arise, and that there is therefore also a very, very practical solution.
Of course, yeah, of course. And I think that when talking about this subject, because we talk about movements and we've also mentioned rhythm, and a hot topic for the last sort of 5 years has been yoga.
Right.
Would you say that it's in any way related? Is yoga beneficial?
Yes, absolutely. Anything that moves your body is beneficial, anything. There's a huge increase, you know, if I just talk about children, there's a huge increase in children with special educational needs. And when I talk to teachers who have been teachers for a long time, the general figure that comes out is that 50% of our children are struggling with some sort of issue. Maybe not severe enough to require one-to-one intervention, but serious enough to cause a problem. So half of our children are not developing as they should and are facing challenges that a generation or two ago they didn't have to face. So there's a societal issue going on here. And because movement develops the brain, and we know movement develops the brain, one of those reasons is the fact that we don't move anymore as we used to. So women don't move as much when they're pregnant, and when you're pregnant and you're moving around and the baby is moving within that amniotic sac, it starts to develop its vestibular system, which is all about your balance system and where you are in space and what weighs up and what weighs down. And if that system doesn't develop properly, then nothing else develops properly. And then similarly, babies don't move anymore. Babies spend all their time on their back, so they don't ever get proper head control. So that's all those neck reflexes, dyslexia, dyscalculia, dyspraxia, all sit in the neck reflexes. Toddlers don't move anymore. You know, mobile phones are the absolute bane of everybody's life because they take up all that attention, and children don't move. So they don't move, they don't play. We're much more sedentary. So, and of course, playtimes are reduced and playing fields are sold off. And I live next door to a playground. Often there's very few children playing, you know, and I've been passed around and I say, there's been nobody there. So that's part of the issue. That's part of the reason why we're having such a problem, is that people just don't move. So anything that you do that moves your body is brilliant. And running a mile isn't going to do it. You know, it needs to be proper movement, going upside down, spinning around, rolling down hills. Rolling down a hill neurologically is one of the best things you can possibly do for your child's development, because as they roll downhill, they have all that proprioceptive input into their body, you know, as they go over and over. So proprioception is about, where am I in space? Where are my arms? Where are my legs? Where's my up? Where's my down? You know, where am I? And if you don't get enough input into that, then and that's when you see people who tap and tap their foot and jiggle their leg and tap their hands. Often it's feedback to the brain, because their brain isn't quite sure where they are. You know, where's my arm? Oh, it's here. I'll tap, tap, tap. So rolling downhill encourages that proprioceptive input, plus your visual development and your hearing development and all that spinning is your vestibular development. It's fantastic. Take your kids rolling down hills.
Best tip so far. That's incredible. I know. I'm going to go tell all my friends. Yeah, don't be scared of letting your kids roll down a hill.
Be scared of letting your kids do stuff. You know, it's all those as a mum. You know, you're overprotective of your children, but all the stuff that dads do. Sorry to be incredibly sexist, but you know, throwing kids up in the air, going on swings that swing really high, going on slides that are really high. Having a bit of jeopardy, climbing trees, climbing anything, going upside down and roundabouts that spin around too fast, all of that stuff develops your brain. So when we don't do it anymore, when we make the world too safe, then children's brains don't develop properly.
Yeah, that's incredible. Can I ask, regarding this subject, does it help with autism as well?
Yes, that was easy, wasn't it? Yeah, because if you look at the symptoms of, I mean, obviously that's a huge generalisation, you know, and I think one of the frustrating things is autism is this huge spectrum from people who are non-verbal and incontinent and in pain and you know, really struggling, all the way through to people like Temple Grandin. You know, I mean, it's this huge spectrum. But when you look at some of the typical symptoms around autism, you know, the things like the anxiety that's often part of the autistic picture, then that fits in very nicely with the retained fear reflex picture that we see when we're looking at reflex integration.
I think the reason it gets sometimes almost awkward talking about these subjects is because of what we mentioned before, because it's not that we're talking about a fix to anything. Sometimes it is just that it makes the rest of it easier. Yeah, it makes coping easier, and that's incredible.
That's the whole point of reflex integration, is it makes life easier. It makes it easier to function in the world. And I think that's so important, because when you're struggling, you know, I still struggle terribly with numbers and working out money and time and anything to do with numbers I really struggle with. I'm better than I was, but, you know, I wish I knew about this when I was a kid. My granddad was a maths teacher. He used to try and teach me maths. And I just, you know, those bits of my brain that process numbers doesn't work.
I can relate to that with lots of other things. So I think it's absolutely, my dad was a cabinet maker and I could not get to grips with that at all.
And of course, as a kid, you feel like such a failure, you know. So you grow up, you know, and you see this with kids with a diagnosis of ADHD who spend their whole lives getting told off. And then we wonder why they have self-esteem issues, you know, and they can't cope with school and school can't cope with them. And, you know, they run from their limbic system. So they're in this kind of state of permanent self-defense, you know, and then they get excluded from school and then they get into trouble and then they end up in prison. And I think, God, if you could just get in early enough, get those reflexes to integrate, make life easier, allow those bits of the brain to connect up, you know, because often with children with ADHD, it's those connections between the limbic system and the prefrontal cortex. So they can't make the logical decisions that you think they should be able to make, because the bit of the brain that makes them isn't connected well. If we can improve those connections, you know,
that's amazing. Yeah, and I think that's why this conversation is so important and this subject is so important. I think it's something that people really do not know very much about at all. I know that I knew from researching before our conversation, and I was absolutely blown away by things that I'd never linked together that make so much sense when you read them once.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's the thing. That's what I found, and that's what I see a lot in my clients, is that it just explains what's going on. You go, okay, well, now I understand. Now I get that. Now I understand that actually my child isn't just being spiteful and aggressive and awful. My child is frightened. So you then all of a sudden the way you approach them is entirely different.
And that's, I think, part of what is the big takeaway from the conversation, is that it makes you double take how you're treating other people, why you're treating them that way and why they're acting that way. It like puts everything into question.
Yeah. See, in an adult environment, an office environment, if you're working in an office with somebody who has retained fear reflexes, not retained enough to give them something pathological, but enough to interfere with their life, they're the people who get upset if you want to move desks, or they're the people who get upset if you want to change how you do things, or they're the people who get upset if you want to do a meeting on a Monday instead of a Friday. And you can think, well, they're just annoying. But actually, they come from a place where they don't feel safe. So as soon as things start to change, it makes them feel less safe. So all they're trying to do is manipulate their environment so they feel safer. They go, oh, okay, I get that now. So
that's amazing. And we've mentioned rhythmic movement training, but something else that was mentioned on your website was functional reflex therapy. And I got really into reflexology a few years ago now.
Yeah.
So it'd be great to touch on that if it's okay.
Yeah, sure. So reflexology obviously is amazing. And functional reflex therapy was developed by a reflexologist and a special needs teacher called Lorraine Senior. And like most things, it is absolute genius because it's really, really simple. So she's taken the very simple principles of reflexology and made them really accessible to parents. So the idea with FRT is that as a parent, you can learn to do the routine. It takes about 15 minutes, I think, probably maximum. And then you do it at home with your child, but you can do it with your child with special needs. You can also do it with your child who doesn't have special needs, or your husband, or your mum, or whoever. You know, it's a really relaxing, really targeted, really simple system that is nice to do and lovely to receive. And because it calms down that whole limbic response, then it makes transition much easier. So if you have a child who's on the spectrum who really struggles with transition, then by giving them a little bit of FRT, it just calms their system, allows everything to settle, and then they're much more able to cope with change of environment or whatever. You know, because transitions are really hard with children on the spectrum. Going from home to school itself is really challenging, and then going from one lesson to another can be really challenging. So if you can do things that helps to ease those transitions, it makes a big difference.
That's amazing, and we should be, and that's what's interesting. That's why I mentioned the schools before, because understanding this subject and being able to think of small things that we can do for each other would alleviate everyone's life so much.
Wouldn't
and it,
it
is
yeah.
sometimes little things that you can do.
Wouldn't
so
it,
it's incredible to learn it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's and this is the other thing that I think is really interesting. When you look at reflexes and reflex integration and how life has changed, when I was at school, we used to do a thing called music and movement, which I personally hated, and I think most people hate it. But actually, when I look back now, the movements that you did with music and movement were all reflex integration movements. And when you look at nursery rhymes all help integrate reflexes. So like Round and Round the Garden helps to integrate hand reflexes. This Little Piggy Went to Market helps to integrate foot reflexes. Row, Row, Row Your Boat helps to integrate neck reflexes. So lots of things that we used to do, our parents did, grandparents, you know, going all the way back, you know, to the plague and everything, where we did round and round the garden, they all help with brain development. And because we didn't understand what we were doing, it's all kind of gone. So even in schools, even doing old-fashioned nursery rhymes and action rhymes and things like that, that all helps with that reflex integration.
It's interesting, and I know it's almost going off topic, but it would be interesting to see this integrated into what kids are doing now, into video games, into, we know that there's video games where you move around and stuff now. If it was actually integrated in a way that was encouraging people to know this stuff, for it to be part of our daily lives, that would be incredible.
It would be incredible, but you need to get away from the video games because video games take up too much processing in the wrong place for what we need it to do. So primitive reflexes live in your brain stem. And video games is all prefrontal cortex stuff.
That's really interesting. So in terms of that, what age would you recommend parents, for example, don't, because I was talking about this recently with someone.
Yeah.
What age would you recommend parents don't let their kids have video games until?
Well, I was talking to somebody yesterday about some new research that's come out from France. And she was saying age 6. Yeah, you absolutely shouldn't let them have a screen till they're 6, which kind of makes sense because 6-7 is the point that your there's a part in your brain in your limbic system called your basal ganglia, which is the bit in your brain that lets you sit still. So if until that's well connected, it's very difficult to be still. Being still is a very high function, high brain function. Which is why Scandinavian countries don't start formal learning until age 7, because developmentally that is the point that you're ready to be able to sit down and learn. So to say that you shouldn't be looking at video games until age 6-7, that kind of makes sense because that's that similar developmental stage.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I'd come to a similar conclusion, probably a bit older almost, and that wasn't even from a scientific or a behaviour aspect, just from marketing on kids, which I absolutely hate. But it's quite obvious, I think, that we've seen a correlation between gaming and mobile phones, as you mentioned before, with kids, because I tend to see two-year-old kids on iPads and mobile phones all the time, and it shocks me.
Yeah.
I didn't have a mobile, and it was a brick, until I was probably like 12, 13. But I think there has been a correlation between a lot more behavioural issues, a lot more issues in general, and the rise of screens.
I think it's really difficult because I think with all of these things it's multifactorial. So I think it's very tempting to jump on one thing and go, well, this is the root of the problem. But I think mobile phones are I think we're going to see increasingly some of the issues that mobile and smartphones, obviously we're talking about here, the problems that they cause. And one of the issues is actually not so much the children, but it's the parents. And the parents being present but absent because they're lost on their phones. And one of the big problems that they're causing, particularly with mums and newborn babies, and I, you know, mums have a hard enough time, so I'm always very wary about any kind of criticism towards new mums. But a baby learns its first point of regulating itself through its limbic system, through eye contact with mum, and response to mum's contraction and dilation of her pupils. So, which used to happen fairly naturally when you sat and fed. You know, if you're feeding or bottle feeding, breastfeeding or bottle feeding, you make eye contact with your baby. So you make eye contact with your baby, and sometimes you watch the telly, but there's still a degree of making eye contact. Now, with the advent of smartphones take up more of your concentration even than the television does. So people, you know, and I've seen it often where people are sitting feeding their baby, they're not looking at their baby, they're not even glancing at their baby, they're lost in their phone. So that first stage of being able to regulate yourself, so by regulation that is get control of your emotional, the emotional part of your brain, isn't happening to the same extent because mothers are not looking at their babies, they're looking at their phones. So that, and then instead of having regulation mother to baby and adult to child, you then start to get more peer-to-peer regulation, and then that then has its own issues.
That's the thing with humans, isn't it? We come up with all this clever stuff and don't think of what other things it's breaking, because who'd have thought that it's such a natural thing to look at your baby when you're feeding it. And then you start adding distractions that humans have created, and eventually that breaks something that's so intrinsic and natural.
And we are, human beings need to connect. We need to have that connection. And when we don't have that connection, that's really where problems start to arise. And in fact, I think that's the whole basis of Johan Harry's book on addiction, is it's the lack of connection. We're looking for a connection. And some of that is to do to back, going back to trauma. Some of it actually is to do with trauma and the damage that trauma does to your developing brain. You know, when babies are traumatized, children are traumatized, it affects the connections in the brain. It affects the structure of your brain. So consequently, you are less able to make those connections. You know, there's things like attachment disorder, but those parts of the brain that should be able to make those connections aren't there. So, and then you get things like addictions.
No, I was thinking that it completely, like, you can see such a direct link between this and quite a few other subjects that I've either talked about on the podcast or have coming up that I would have never seen a link in. And as you said, it's something that a lot of this stuff we're talking about was so natural and should have happened in quite a natural way. So, of course, we don't talk about it. It should have just happened naturally.
So we're not aware that it's a problem. Why would you be aware that that's a problem? Because that's what everybody's doing, the same thing. So it's fine. Why is it an issue? So, and it's only when you start to drill down and see some of the issues. And that's the thing about the traumatized brain. And what I said right at the beginning, you know, where people go for counselling. And counselling's great because it can take things from the subconscious and make them conscious, and then you can process them. But sometimes it isn't great, particularly for children, because recalling an incident can itself be re-traumatizing, whereas trauma is a physical process. It's not an intellectual process. It's a physical process of your body responding to whether you should fight, flight, freeze or flop. If you're not able to do those things, then that's when trauma really becomes somatized into the body. And that's why movement techniques are really, really good at dealing with that trauma and dealing with being able to allow the brain to develop as it should, because you are able to use the body is able to use that movement to deal with those traumatic incidents that it couldn't deal with before.
Yeah, it's really interesting actually, because When I mentioned before, whilst being homeless, during that period of time, I went for counselling, and found it it wasn't helpful for me at all at that time, because the process it wanted me to go through quite literally took me away from what I needed to be doing for coping with being homeless. The situation, I was going out, I was clubbing, I was meeting people. That's what actually helped me survive that situation. Yeah, and the counselling was trying to break that away because of bad habits. So it was really difficult. And it's interesting to talk about that and hear it said from
you
someone.
You see, this is the thing with addiction that I think is really interesting. I'm writing a blog post at the moment, or an article on trauma and addiction and rhythmic movement training, which has become a really big article.
Oh, excellent. I look forward to reading it.
It's now like, oh, this could be a chapter in a book.
Oh, excellent.
This could be a book. So I'm trying to cut it down a bit. But it is so interesting when you start to look at it, and when you look at the effect of trauma on the brain, and then you look at the effect of addiction on the brain, and how addiction is usually to try and self-medicate the trauma, and then that addiction itself, particularly with drug addiction itself increases the damage to the brain that the trauma started, so which is why you then end up with this kind of escalating state. But if you can catch it and change it and work with that trauma rather than focus on the addiction, you focus on the trauma, then the addiction itself becomes less necessary, because you're dealing with the cause, not the symptom.
That's amazing. Well, I look forward to reading that article.
I will. Yes, so do I.
Or book, if it ends up being a book.
Stuff.
And obviously, once that comes out, I will add it to the description so that people can catch it, because I'm sure they'll be interested to read that. Is there anything that you would like to leave listeners with? Something that you think is important for people to come away from this with?
Move your body. Move your body, move your whole body. Doesn't matter what you do, move your body. It makes you cleverer, makes life easier to cope with. Move your body, move your kids, dance. You know, dancing. This is why dancing is good for people with dementia. You know, it's repeated patterns that are rhythmic, and then you have the social element as well.
It's so interesting with dancing as well, when you look around at how many cultures had dancing as such a basic part of their everyday to day life, and that's disappearing slowly. Other than in cultures that still hold it really valuable. Fortunately, my culture loves dancing.
Yeah, it's so important. It's so important. You know, food and dancing are the fundamentals in any culture that you go to in the world. Food and dancing, that's what life revolves around.
Oh, well, that's a good takeaway from this conversation. Eat good food and dance.
And dance.
I think that's a very positive way to end this chat. Nikki, I've had such a great chat. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And thank you for your time. I'm so grateful for anybody who's prepared to help me promote this, because I think it is so important and life-changing for so many people.
It is. It is. And I can't wait to get it out and hear what people think about it, because I think that it will really encourage and help a lot of people.
Bless you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you so much to everyone for checking out that episode of Promote the Hell Out of It. And I really do hope you enjoyed it. It means a lot to me. I think it's an episode that can really give relief to a lot of people. So please, please, if you did enjoy it, share it about. And if you've got any questions for me, anything you wish I would have asked, any guest recommendations, anything like that, I would love to hear from you. Go check us out on Instagram, Twitter, or get in touch by any means. We've got that competition from our friends at Next Stand going live on Instagram and Twitter this week, so check that out. I'm also going to be doing an unboxing of some goodies that they sent over our way. Thank you so much for listening. And if you did enjoy that, I'm just going to throw out some recommendations based on some previous episodes that have been really good. Recently had Clara Herbart talking about CBD and how that can help people and give relief in certain situations. Also had Dr. Stephanie Strathdee on the podcast a while back talking about how to fight a superbug and how phages are doing incredible work in that area. Her story is incredible. I would really, really recommend checking that out. And the last one I will throw out there is actually the recommendation I had with Rosie Jacob. We talk about a lot of remote work tips, digital tool nomad tips. We talk about working with your partner and how to deal with that. But there's seriously a lot of tips in that conversation that can really help with day-to-day life and our view on things that I think people can really enjoy. So yeah, check those out and let me know what you think. And as always, catch you next time.